Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. More tonight, I've got a very special guest with me, Tony Gosling, but he's from New Zealand. And welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Well, yeah, I'm actually visiting New Zealand in the Coromandel Peninsula at the moment, which I thoroughly recommend to any of your listeners to get a trip over here to New Zealand. It's a really beautiful country. I think the British colonialists actually did, for a change, did a quite good job in, first of all, not killing off all of the indigenous people here, but actually making land deals with them. The Maoris have now done a lot of deals with the government here in New Zealand, where they've got vast amounts of money in compensation for land, and they're investing that in a lot of the tourist industries around here. So the Maoris are starting to come back, a bit like some of the Native Americans have in North America, to actually create big kind of money-spinning industries of their own, which is quite important, really, considering, you know, what happened all those years ago, George. But look, I mean, the big news this week, of course, is this so-called terrorist attack in London, which, you know, the media are very, very quick to jump to use this term terrorism. What we've got is we've got some guy, apparently, who's driven into a whole load of people on Westminster Bridge, a maniac of some sort, random people, killing random people, and then try to apparently make an attack on Parliament itself. So on the face of it, there certainly does seem to be an attempt to use terror. But there's a tremendous number of anomalies. Of course, the biggest one, you've got to start with this, even though for many of the London media who've been covering this, and the world, Western world's media, including, incidentally, China and Russia, which I'm very disappointed in, is they're not really raising any questions about the suspect being shot dead straight away. This is a characteristic of a cover-up. It's characteristic of a false flag operation. It's characteristic of any kind of attack which has been prearranged, where the person who's been shot dead, like Lee Harvey Oswald, is a patsy. And yet, very, very little questioning of the whole shooting dead of this guy. So that, for me, is the number one, George. I wonder what you make of this, because, of course, at the end of the day, it means that there will be no kind of proper criminal charges, legal proceedings, anything like that, on the one hand. So it shuts down any kind of legal questions that might be asked of the police about the behaviour last week. Also, there is no restrictions on the reporting. So this guy can be called a terrorist, a maniac, anything. The media gets a free rein to say exactly what they want, and of course most of the London media has been doing exactly that, calling him a terrorist, saying that he did it, even though actually all the information we've got is from the Metropolitan Police and from the media. I mean, if you were in a court case, you would be expecting to hear from all different people, all different eyewitnesses, including those that contradict the official account of events. And we've got plenty of those, George.
Yeah, you know, Gladio sort of reminds me in a way. Is this the beginning of a Gladio operation in the UK, you think? I know Gladio was on the mainland there of Europe. Are y'all beginning to see more and more of these attacks, you think, over there? This could be a beginning of a tensioning of the British population?
Definitely. I mean, I think we have to really stand back from this attack a little bit and from the coverage of it. It's been interesting watching the coverage in New Zealand, because it's just literally using BBC reporters to do the coverage. But there are lots of very important anomalies that are not being talked about. First of all, this is the most camera'd up country in the world. All the whole area around Parliament is also got cameras everywhere, closed circuit television, which should have been recording every single step of this terrorist attack from probably 10 different angles, George. And yet there's been none of that at all. No footage has been released of the attack. And on our 9/11 forum, it's been pointed out, this is the 9/11forum.org.uk, which was set up a couple of years after the 9/11 attacks, precisely for the purpose of discussing terrorist attacks like this. It is one of the bright sparks on there has pointed out that Westminster Council has agreed a controversial move to turn off its entire network of CCTV cameras, if you can believe that. That was on the 6th of June last year. Central London Council made the controversial decision to switch off its entire network of CCTV. It's Conservative-run council, and it's just as an effort, apparently, to cut costs. Now, you can believe this if you like or not, but it seems to me incredible that as some sort of penny-pinching, cost-cutting measure, one of the richest councils in the country can say, oh, well, that CCTV network which is put in place all around Parliament, we're just going to turn it off.
What is the new mayor of London? What is he? How does he enter into this thing? He is what, Islam or what? Islamic?
Well, he's a Muslim. Yeah,
yeah, he's a Muslim.
One of the only. I think Holland has also got a city, one of its major cities, which has got a Muslim mayor. But he's been coming out with the usual rhetoric, assuming effectively that what the press is telling him and what the police are telling him is true. That this is some kind of Islamic attack. ISIS have claimed the attack, but then, you know, you've got to look at all sorts of questions about that. Who is ISIS? Who created ISIS? Who funds ISIS through Switzerland? Of course, it's the Gulf Cooperation Council states mainly, plus the CIA, probably British money going in there from MI6 too. And yet that's never discussed. The ISIS is actually wouldn't be there without the help from our allies in the Gulf, that is people like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, by the way, of course, as well. So these things are not talked about, even though, I just find it incredible that there isn't any real pulling apart of who ISIS are. Also, of course, the conduits that are used to release information from ISIS is the Akbar news agency, which ISIS itself has said that we refute anything that comes from them, and yet the Western press still use them apparently a good source for confirming or denying or whatever that ISIS is involved in an attack. The other one is Rita Katz and her site news agency just near Washington, D.C., and she used to work for the Mossad, Rita did.
Right.
And there are all sorts of questions about whether the videos that she's been putting out, I mean, she was one of the people that put out those Bin Laden videos, if you remember those, around about 2003, 2004, which are now laughed at, really, as hoaxes, as fakes, where Bin Laden is supposedly speaking, but his face is not moving, his mouth is not moving for most of the video. You just get a little bit of movement. And these are quite clearly fake videos, and yet the same source is being used now by the Western media to say, oh, well, ISIS has confirmed that they are behind this attack. So that is absolute nonsense. I'll just run through some of the anomalies I've spotted so far. And, of course, you would maybe expect one or two anomalies in any attack, but when you get so many, I've just got six here. First of all, as I say, the suspect is shot dead. No need to shoot him dead. Although he was a knife-wielding attacker, he could very easily have been shot his legs, shot his arms, basically to bring him down, to disarm him, or they could have used a taser. So they had several different options, but no, they decided to kill the guy to avoid any kind of awkward court case questions. So that Lee Harvey Oswald aspect to it all is number one for me. I mean, if you kill the suspect, then there's no questions. Dead men tell no tales, and you just move on, and you have to accept whatever the press is telling you about an attack. But then there were also reports from Daniel Sanford at the BBC about multiple other occupants of the car that did this killing spree along the pavement at Westminster Bridge. So that's the BBC saying that. Apparently some guy with a goatee beard, a dark-skinned guy with a goatee beard, and also another white, bald-headed man apparently were also with him during this attack. But they just either ran or walked off and weren't apprehended. So this is a very interesting side that some eyewitnesses, some of them who apparently were police who were there, said this to Daniel Sanford at the BBC. Then, of course, the guy that's finally been named as the suspect is apparently a Muslim convert. And he was also known to MI5. Now, this, again, does point towards him being a patsy, manipulated into this. We've had quite a lot of people who are Muslim converts. For example, the guy who was the shoe bomber, he was a Muslim convert. We have one in Bristol who was a Muslim convert. People who have got no real interest and haven't been brought up as Muslims, but then they've somehow been convinced by somebody to become a Muslim. These make perfect patsies, and they're easy to manipulate. But also, of course, this MI5 have been following this guy. They admit that they know who he is. They've been following his career. They have records on him. And yet, of course, he wasn't followed closely enough, and they did nothing to stop him doing this attack. Also, he was born and brought up in the UK. So all of the xenophobia about, we've got to watch out for the foreigners, blah, blah, this guy doesn't fit into that category at all. He was brought up in Luton in Bedfordshire, apparently, and he was born in Britain. So he's basically a violent British criminal turned Muslim convert. Now, this to me, and of course, he's not around anymore to deny this. So this is a label which is being put on him, which he can't refute, which he might well do, of course, if he had the chance to a court case, say, well, I'm not a Muslim or whatever. He may refute these things. Also, very strange that MI5 didn't intervene to stop him, even though he was being watched by them and he was also a violent criminal. Apparently, he was able to easily get a job as a teacher in Britain. And then, finally, my other anomaly is that the security correspondent on Channel 4 News, Simon Israel, got completely the wrong name. He actually named the guy, obviously being told by MI5 who had done the attack, as completely the wrong person. In fact, during a live Channel 4 News program, the guy who Simon Israel named as the attacker, his brother phoned up and said, it's not him because he's in jail. I just visited him a couple of days ago. It's definitely not this guy. So you've got false information, disinformation being fed to the journalists, to gullible journalists like Simon Israel on Channel 4 News by the security services. Again, George, I mean, it's starting to stack up at least six or seven different reasons why you would think that there is this is a put-up job. It's basically theatre. It's not a lone wolf. And the fact that there's been something like seven arrests, several other people detained in Birmingham as a result of this attack, also implies that he wasn't acting alone. Why would the police be arresting a whole lot of other people connected with him and detaining them if after a couple of days of having been arrested, they're still in detention? If this was a lone wolf attack, I think it's pretty obvious to me that that there is much, much more to this than we're being told, and that this is just another one of those attacks, part of a strategy of tension designed in order to try and make us relinquish our civil liberties. Oh, we've got to have effectively a police state.
Right. They're coming up with all these fake news sites now. Oh, are y'all running into that over in the UK or at all? I mean,
well, the whole fake news phenomenon, of course, is a fake in itself.
It is, isn't it?
Celebrities. We were having a laugh with a New Zealand couple the other day. Justin Bieber, he's fake news. You know, this guy shouldn't even be on the news. He's got very little talent. You know, there is a tremendous amount of stuff which pushed in front of our faces, which really shouldn't be there. It's done to create this kind of fake celebrity status. But look, this police state stuff is getting serious. You've got 100,000 or so, I mean, I don't know, it's tens of thousands, certainly, people employed in the Department of Homeland Security in the United States. It's basically a gravy train, and the security state and paranoia is an industry in itself. Part of a massive amount of our taxpayers' money is now going to feed this security state. But look, a couple of things with our London attack which indicate a police state. First of all, you've got a massive boost to a security on the Houses of Parliament. Now, I don't know if you've ever visited the Houses of Parliament, George, on one of your trips to Britain. Have you ever been over here?
Yes, I've been over there a couple of times. Yeah, you bet. I've been to Ireland.
Well, if you
London,
ever try and visit Parliament as a tourist, even, you will see there is a massive amount
of security. Oh, gosh, they're all over the place.
It is impossible to get past the armed guards.
I know.
How did this guy get past these armed guards? Absolutely ridiculous. Anyone that's even been there to lobby their MP will find out that there are ridiculous numbers of security checks, two or three sometimes, and there are various walls of armed police. Now, apparently this guy just waltzed straight past, dancing maybe, past these armed police to get very close to the actual Parliament building itself. So there must have been some kind of deliberate takedown of the security system at the Houses of Parliament. None of this has been mentioned or commented on by the London press. Also, this shoot-to-kill policy. This has been brought in surreptitiously. Effectively, the police are now able to basically, what they say is, oh, because you may be wearing a suicide vest, well, I mean, you know, I don't know how you decide whether someone is or not, but anyway, anyone could be. Maybe a completely innocent person who's not even connected with terrorism at all could be wearing a suicide vest and then get shot in the head because the police think they might be. This is exactly what happened to the innocent guy, Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was shot dead on the London Underground immediately after the 7/7 London bombings. He was an electrician. One of the suspicions about him is that he had some information about what had been going on the London Underground in the immediate days before the 7/7 London bombings, and that potentially he was involved and he knew something, and effectively he was executed. What this does, as has happened with this guy in the London attacks, effectively the guy's been executed, just like Jean-Charles de Menezes was executed by the police. This is a sure sign of a coming police state. This is what happened to Mark Duggan back in 2013 when we had all the riots in Britain, in Brixton. He was unarmed, and yet he was shot dead by the police. Just a little bit earlier on this year, up in Huddersfield, there was another guy who was pulled over by the police. He didn't have a gun. Apparently, he didn't have a gun in the car, or he certainly wasn't holding a gun. The police executed him. This shoot-to-kill policy is there for one purpose and one purpose only, not just to protect the police, because that's what they always say. It's there to stop any kind of court case against the police, and it's also there to release the media to say anything they want to smear the person. If the person is allowed to survive, and if they're alive, they can then sue the press for defamation of character. If the police shoot them on the scene and kill them on the scene, then the press can say whatever they want, and they can run out any old nonsense rubbish story on the press about them they want to, without any fear of ever being sued. So this guy could have been maimed, he could have been disarmed, he could have been tasered. There's all sorts of things that could have happened to him. But no, he's shot dead by the police, effectively executed. It means there's no judicial process. And if there is an inquest into the guy's death, the authorities, as we've seen with the London bombings in 7/7, the coroner can just say, well, no jury, and the coroner can decide for themselves. So this is a way of getting round judicial process and due process of law, George. Just kill the guy. Is exactly what they did to Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. Last year, towards the end of Obama's administration, two U.S. senators, Rob Portman and Chris Murphy, had passed a bill. The name of it was Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act. It was supposedly put forward and made part of the National Defense Authorization Act. And this is supposedly to counter disinformation and propaganda and stuff. This is the beginning of the end for alternative news sites. See what I mean?
Well, it could be. Although I think, you know, there are people like me, George, who will just keep going whatever, by whatever means. I mean, for example, I was on the radio here in New Zealand just the other day talking about what has been a massive story over here for the whole week this week, which is about the New Zealand security forces in Afghanistan running what is effectively a punishment killing five Afghanis after one of their SAS men was blown up in a roadside bomb. They then went in and five Afghani people, innocent people, civilians, were then killed. And then there was a subsequent cover-up after it. And Nikki Hager, Hager, has brought out a book just this week explaining that number one, there's been this cover-up, and secondly, that there's these punishment killings going on. Now, they're not actually blaming the New Zealand SAS themselves, because what happened was the New Zealand SAS went in to do what they thought was an arrest of people who were involved in killing their colleague. And as the various civilians ran away, there was an American Apache helicopter that just mowed everybody down, all these civilians, including a three-year-old child. And this has been big news over here. But, of course, it hasn't really hit the headlines in Britain and the United States, because that is the way that the news works these days, is that it's kept very, very local to the country concerned, like literally just here in New Zealand. Nicky Harger, by the way, is a fantastic investigative journalist. He was the person who, in the mid-1990s, exposed the Echelon program. I don't know if you remember that.
I know about that. 1990s,
most of us suddenly realized what was going on with Echelon. That was because Nicky Harger, with his security service contacts here in New Zealand, wanted the world, and they wanted the world, not him. The people who worked for the security services here in New Zealand wanted the world to know what mainly the British and the US were up to, because they weren't happy with it. And so he's a very important relief valve for people who are on the inside here in New Zealand to let them know about what's going on in the world. And this SAS book, it's called Hit and Run. It's just out, and it's just the latest example of what is some brilliant investigative journalism that he's been doing over here, George, where literally soldiers have been coming to him saying, look, we were involved in this, we didn't like it, and he's managing to get this out to the much wider public, and possibly even getting a national inquiry, public inquiry, into the cover-up by their New Zealand Defence Forces.
Yeah, I mean, the corruption. You know what President Trump's running into that I see is that he campaigned on draining the swamp and all that. We have multiple levels of bureaucratic swamp here in the country, in the United States. And boy, I don't know if he's going to drain even a part of it. You know what I mean?
Well, I think even if he wanted to, he would find it difficult, George.
Well, the deep state, Peter Del Scott written extensively about the deep state, and the deep state is strong in the Five Eyes group. You know what I mean? And that Five Eyes, New Zealand's part of the Five Eyes group.
See? It is, yeah.
And so,
along with Canada, Australia, Britain, and the U.S. But yeah, I always find it fascinating that they've called it Five Eyes, because
Surely
each of the states should have two eyes each. That's 10 eyes, isn't it? Unless, of course, they're only one eye in the middle of their forehead and they're some kind of weird Illuminati character.
Well, that word panopticon came out of Great Britain, by the Bentham and them, panopticon, where they started out where they were going to design a prison where they could see from one location all the prisoners, see? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's effectively what the NSA and GCHQ are up to right now. They're doing quite well at it, too.
Well, the Palantir, are you familiar with this company?
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah, that right there is the they're feeding the Bilderberg group, Peter Thiel is right there at the on the steering committee.
This is another thing we must mention, and that's the death of David Rockefeller too.
Yes, hopefully. We've got to talk about that. Yeah, what are your comments on that, Tony? I've followed it for years myself, but go ahead.
He's done quite well, George, hasn't he? 101. I mean, I'd be very pleased if I make it to 101. Let's just look at his family. It was Ida Tarbell back in, 1920.
She's one of my heroes, Ida Tarbell. Yeah.
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 Amazing book that she wrote about the Standard Oil. Really exposing the way that, because what John D. Rockefeller was doing back in those days, he was being really sneaky. Absolutely up for a bit of capitalism. That is to say, someone with a bit of money and a bit of initiative going out and starting a business and making a name for themselves, especially if they're providing a public service, a service that the public wants to buy. No problem with that at all. But what he was doing, John Rockefeller was secretly buying up his competition, and he was using the competition that he bought up to spy on his real competition. The other thing he was doing was this whole business of vertical integration. So he started off with buying oil fields, then he bought the petrol stations, the gas station, Standard Oil sign started going up on gas stations across America. Then he started buying the refineries, and so he was every little bit in the chain, right the way from drilling the oil out of the ground and refining it, right the way to where the customer buys it. He was involved in every single stage and owning every single stage personally. And then what he started to do was, of course, one of the big things with oil is transporting it around. After having bought the railways that were transporting the oil, he would transport his oil around the United States and around the world for free on his own railways, whereas all the other competition were having to pay. And I think at this stage, people realized that this is a giant octopus. It could take the whole world over. And that's when Ida Tarbell came along and wrote her book. But the problem, even after Standard Oil was split up into Unocal, Texaco, Esso, these various different sections, of course, the Rockefeller family kept the shares in those various companies. They didn't take the shares off of the Rockefeller family. Then as David Rockefeller came along, he started branching out from oil into banking and the Chase Manhattan Bank and other banks, because he realized actually this was a bigger racket than oil, because you could just, if you owned a bank, you could just print as much money as you wanted and then just either give it to your friends or lend it to your friends, and then when they said, oh, they can't pay it back, you say, never mind, so you're my friend, you know. So it basically turned banking slowly into a kind of mafia industry.
Right. Well, you create the credits, you know, out of thin air and lend it out at interest. That's a pretty big racket, that's for sure.
It is, definitely. I mean, it is. It's, and, of course, they've bought up the regulation of their own industry now. What with the bailout in 2008, they've used that money to lobby for even more freedoms so they can do it all again whenever they feel like it in the future.
Well, your BIS comes to my mind as much, you know what I mean? And I know that you've read that book and so forth. The Tower of Basel, I think it was called.
Yeah, Basel. It's pronounced Basel in Switzerland. Basel, that's a really interesting area, isn't it?
Yeah,
and where all the Nazi rat lines were at the end of the Second World War as well.
American was director of it at the time, and there was an American director of the BIS during the war, you know, during that period. they were all together,
Alan,
you know.
Dulles. Huh? Alan Dulles.
And then Alan Dulles was in Bern. Over there doing his OSS thing, and they were all working together, making money, right?
The Nazis absolutely relied on the Swiss right the way through the war for all their foreign exchange, and then the Swiss are really very discreet. You know, you give them anything, put it in a safe deposit box there. Yes, they'll give you, you know, you will incur bank charges, but no one will ever know what you've got under the Swiss mountains.
Right, right. There's a recent book. I interviewed a man, you know, on that scandal over there about secret bank accounts. But the problem is they just go to other countries now outside of Switzerland to maintain and establish these secret bank accounts. So,
well, the Swiss are still doing secret bank accounts. But look, you know, after the death of David Rockefeller, which has got very little coverage, I've seen, even though he's an incredibly powerful, very, very influential man, and really, I would consider a U.S. politician, even though he would never agree to that. He's a sort of guy that bankrolls politicians, basically, and bankrolls political parties, bankrolls candidates.
Well, what are
enormous amounts of media ownership and controlling of elections.
You know, one of the worst things that he did.
The key thing was he was one of the main members of the Bilderberg Steering Committee, you know, this organization which I've been looking at for many years. And the interesting thing to note about that is the people who have replaced him on the Bilderberg Steering Committee, much, much younger. We're talking about the likes of Peter Thiel, you mentioned earlier on, of Eric Schmidt, people like this. And these are, I think, the technocrats of tomorrow. Even beyond back, I mean, it's almost the corruption and the oligarchy started with these kind of oil barons. Then they moved into banking. And now it looks to me as if they're moving into social media, internet, and high-tech internet communications and surveillance.
Right.
And things like this Palantir system, which you talked about. These are the owners of this technology that are now on that Bilderberg Steering Committee, who are coordinating a lot of the policy right across the Western world, George. And, of course, it's the NATO countries we're talking about. Sometimes people talk about, oh, the Bilderberg rule the world. They don't. They've got big competitors around the world, in Africa, in China, in Russia, in the Middle East, etc. It's just the NATO countries, really, which are the core of the Bilderberg meetings. And yet the individuals who are now running the show there, although Although they're assisted by the bankers, obviously, the Goldman Sachs types, they provide the funds for them to go and do their mafia deeds on the internet, whoever they are, set up these companies which are doing mass surveillance, like Facebook, which is Peter Thiel's baby. And then they invite the likes of Google along, Microsoft, Amazon, LinkedIn, Twitter, all along to the Bilderberg conferences now. I think that's where the power is going to be lying in the future, even if it's not already, is in this vast, vast database of knowledge of people's social networks and about who's who out there in the world, which is why countries like Iran have tried to ban Facebook. I mean, they're basically failing to do it because there are ways around it. The kids will find ways around these things, and the NSA will help the kids to find ways around the censorship of Facebook in Iran. But this is becoming a massive surveillance tool. The NSA and Facebook, Peter Thiel, people like this can use to garner information about vast populations. And then they use these programs like this Palantir program in order to use what they've gained through Facebook and through other mass data trawls and giant databases that they've stolen or bought in order to inform governments on what their policy should be. So they've become almost indispensable advisors to some of the senior decision makers in the political parties.
That word Palantir comes out of Lord of the Rings. It's a seeing stones, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they use all this occult and all this esoteric stuff to name their companies. They tell you who they are, you know.
They're doing that because they know the kids are all into this stuff. You know?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. They love it, man. The millennials, they love this stuff, huh?
Yeah, and of course it makes it seem like it's, you know, it's part of some fluffy film or whatever. But at the end of the day, these are really intrusive, pernicious technologies, and they are tools in a way, weapons against our rights and our privacy. And, you know, as we were talking about, I think it was just last week, George, there is this war going on against people who are young political activists, anybody that's trying to set up something which may be a challenge to the oligarchy. They're scanning, you know, they're scanning everything that's going on. Oh, this looks like it might be a challenge to us. Therefore, we'll have to swat it like a fly before it gets too big. And so this is a big disincentive on people to, you know, be successful activists, start new political parties, and to start anything new, really, and when, of course, that nothing to challenge the status quo.
Right. You know, I mean, it's just the mechanism that I see after I've studied this for 35 years is immense in scope. You know what I mean? David Rockefeller, they got into medical, you know what I mean, early on. Eustace Mullins wrote a book, Death by Injection, exposed a lot of this stuff. But the medical stuff that David Rockefeller did was so detrimental to good health. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Just one area.
Yeah, it's just one thing. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And of course, the banks are at the back of a lot of this because they will fund. I mean, let's just look at the genetic technology, for example, as another side of things. Well, this is, first of all, this genetic modified foods and vegetables, this kind of thing. Not only is it a nightmare for farmers because it means they have to keep going back to the same people to get the same seeds. They can't keep their own seeds, etc. They've got to go back to the factory and get a whole new bunch because the seeds aren't infertile, this so-called Terminator technology. But it also means that the environment of the natural versions of these plants is polluted. In fact, you could go back to Ian Fleming and James Bond and his film on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which stars Telly Savalas. It's a particularly good James Bond film. And what the evil Telly Savalas is doing in his mountaintop hideout in Switzerland is exactly this. He's threatening to pollute the genetic chains of important species on the planet. And so, you know, James Bond is sent in to do something about him. And in fact, the funny thing about that particular book that Ian Fleming wrote into it was that the government had basically decided to cave in. You know, and so Bond had to go in as a kind of freelance agent and do his own nobbling of Telly Savalas. So, you know, this is something which has been around with us for decades in our popular culture. And, of course, Fleming knew a hell of a lot. He was from a banking family, Fleming's Bank in London, and he'd also been a senior officer in British naval intelligence in the Second World War and had seen a tremendous amount, including the being involved in the operation to kidnap Martin Bormann. Well, not exactly kidnap him, because, of course, he was willingly taken back to Britain at the end of the Second World War. There's a lot of rubbish talked, particularly by the Germans, about Bormann dying at the end of the Second World War, being killed in Berlin in the bunker with Hitler. Bormann being Hitler's treasurer, his personal assistant, basically the man who controlled access to Hitler for the last few years of the war. And so everyone that wanted to speak to him had to go through Bormann. Bormann would also be present and so could poison the Führer's mind against anybody. He was a bit like a kind of worm tongue character from The Lord of the Rings, George. And the important thing about Bormann is it was his signature that was on all the biggest, the most important bank accounts, Swiss bank accounts that the Nazis held. And so the British needed him to sign those checks after the war to get the looted millions for themselves. And this is what a lot of the traitors were involved in. This is why Fleming wrote his James Bond books. And a lot of people don't realize this, that Ian Fleming was a drunk after the Second World War, and it was only once he started writing, because he was so depressed about the treachery at the end of the war. It was only once he started writing and getting these things he knew off his chest in a fictional form as part of the James Bond novel. So in a way, they're a kind of coded message to posterity about what he knew about what had been going on in World War II. So they're well worth watching those films, particularly the early ones, and reading the books, because Fleming is telling us, look, this is how crooked leaders like people like Churchill and, I mean, we're even talking about the King, King George VI, who, of course, is part of a German family. He was one of the people involved in this Bormann operation, too. And that is something that very few people realize, just what Fleming was trying to let us know, that we had traitors within our own gates. And, of course, those traitors did very, very well out of getting all that money after the war. 750 companies Bormann set up after the war, and much of the looted wealth from World War II was injected into those companies, which have now dominate much of the commerce in the Western world.
Right, they IG Farben, they came out of a lot of that. But Port and Downs figured you were touching on this microbiology angle or just a few minutes ago. But Port and Downs figures prominently in early microbiology development and so forth.
Well, of course, the guy David Kelly, who was the scientist who was killed in Britain at the time of the 2003 Iraq invasion, he was one of the chief officers at Port and Down. And, of course, he knew a lot about what dodgy stuff was going on, and I think that was one of the reasons he was killed, not just because he had been leaking to the BBC the fact that the case against Saddam Hussein had been fabricated. I mean, that's effectively what he did. He went to the BBC Today programme, the main daily BBC News radio show, and he said, well, this is a dodgy dossier. This has all been faked, and there is no excuse to go into Iraq. And we have him, although he passed away, obviously, he was killed, even though it was attempted to make it look like suicide. He was a very, very decent guy. So it's interesting to see that quite often behind in the shadows, there are some really honest, decent people who just...
You're dropping out a little bit.
Cannot speak out. Not all of them can do what Ian Fleming did and write novels and get their stuff out in fictional form, because they know that if they were to say anything about what they really know in fact, that they would be arrested and probably sent to jail. A kind of Chelsea Manning or, Edward Snowden-type characters who would probably be jailed for what they know. But they had the very clever idea of writing it all out in fictional form, which I think many whistleblowers today would be well advised to do that.
Right. At what one company that I've been tracking and looking at is Kinetic. It's spelled differently than you would think of. It's not with a K, it's with a Q. Okay? And this company came out of the Port and Down period. And it is sort of the new model that I see for the new up and coming defense oriented, research oriented, security oriented. It's spelled Q-I-N-E-T-I-Q, Kinetic. And it's a company that I've got onto several years ago. Oh yeah, it's a big corporation. And but it looks like to me as the model of the new upcoming international transnational companies with security and research.
Well, if you look at the way it's spelt.
Yeah. Yeah.
They took over the old I think it's Research Evaluation Defense Agency. Defense Evaluation and Research Agency, which was developing all new weapons. They had a big place down at what's it called? In the North Downs, near where I lived, in just outside southeast London, Fort Halstead, it was called. It was one of these sort of mysterious places you pass on the road from London to Hastings on the A21 on the right hand side on the North Downs, and there it was. The whole thing has been privatised. That's now Kinetic.
That
place was where the British atomic bomb was developed. In the late 1940s and 1950s, these were the guys that were doing all sorts of, you know, sort of weapons research. The idea of privatizing that to me seems absolutely insane. Number one, insane, because of course their loyalty is not to the country where they're being funded from and they're operating. They may wish to sell the stuff they're developing if they can make a bit more money to your enemies. So why you would privatize something like that is just totally beyond me, George. I don't know if you can figure out why.
Well, you know, that public-private partnership stuff, it came out of Thatcher's government, by the way. But also, the Bilderberg is always espousing that. And then at Davos, you know, the World Economic Forum, they're doing it too. And they're just transferring these kinds of formerly public resources and assets into their own private hands.
Yeah, I mean, if you're privatizing defense, you're building up a big, big problem for the future. Because you're doing effectively is you're putting your defense industry number one on the open market, whether it's the black market, you know, getting around. You may be that you're prevented from selling those weapons to a certain country, but that just means you double the price when you do. So they're available on the black market. But more importantly, it also subjects your whole military to defense contract fraud. So you get people who are trying to con ministers, and maybe with Masonic handshakes too, getting ministers to sign contracts which are actually for junk, which is useless to the soldiers themselves and to the airmen and to the naval officers. So we had an example of that, for example, with in Afghanistan. This very expensive piece of kit was being sold to the British Army in Afghanistan for scanning. It was supposed to scan for explosives. Was nothing but a piece of wood with a kind of knitting needle stuck in the end of it. There was nothing to it. It didn't even operate. It didn't work. It was just there as a psychological tool to make people who were being checked think that they were being checked for something, and they sold these things for thousands and thousands of pounds, even though it was just a lump of wood with a knitting needle in it. That's the sort of thing that you get when you privatize your defense procurement industry and your arms industry. The Russians spend much, much less than Britain and America on weapons, and yet their weapons actually work. When you need them to use them in a conflict, in a fight, in a warlike situation, the Russian weapons will work 10 times better than the British and the American ones, because they're designed and they're tested by people who have got a very much definite national interest in making sure they do, not just trying to develop those weapons to make money.
Right. You know, you brought up Ian Fleming, but he was warning us through Spectre. Remember Spectre, that group? Well, the Bilderberg and all them, they've actually, that sounds like Spectre to me. You know what I mean? See what I mean? Huh? We've got Spectre out there. You know,
it
exists already. We just don't know about all the details, see?
Yeah, I mean, I'd also add to the list of really good authors who were involved at key stages in the Second World War. There were people who were really right in the middle of things through World War II, you know, like Fleming, who had signed the Official Secrets Act, that knew that he couldn't say a word about it. And in fact, he would be considered a total traitor by his close personal friends and colleagues if he were to. But you could write it through fiction, and it was Dennis Wheatley was another writer who did exactly the same. He was what they called in the Second World War a deception planner, very close to people like Winston Churchill, Desmond Morton, the people who were really running the war, at least the so-called civilians, although Morton was a major, army major. So Wheatley then in his novels after World War II, he created this character who was a German spy, Gregory Sallust, and he wrote about four or five, maybe six, even seven books based on this guy who'd been a, you know, he kind of put himself into the personality of this dashing British spy who spoke fluent German and that kept going over to the continent impersonating and stealing uniforms and impersonating high-ranking Nazi officers in order to get information back to Britain. And his novels contain a lot of information, for example, about the strategy, the way the war went. One of the things that I was reading a while ago was the disaster of the invasion of Italy. And he was able to express his own opinion about the absolutely dreadful manner in which the American and the British generals conducting the war attacked Italy, started off through Sicily and Corsica, and had to fight the whole way up Italy. I mean, most people with any sense realized that you needed to have some kind of invasion halfway up Italy in order to split the forces, you know, and in order to mean that you didn't have to fight every single inch of ground all the way up to the north of Italy. So he was pointing out what a disastrous strategy that was. Also, another thing he points out is just what a disaster, about a month or so after D-Day, there was absolutely no movement. In other words, that Patton and Eisenhower and Montgomery's troops were almost pinned down. They weren't actually managing to take any ground, even though they'd got a bridgehead and they were funneling supplies in through the Normandy beaches. They weren't actually able to make any progress getting across towards Berlin, and he explains why that was and what they did to stop it, for example. So it's actually well worth reading Dennis Wheatley, and particularly the use of the occult in order to trick Hitler into thinking that he could trust certain advisers and not trust other advisers by telling his, reading his astrological stars and this kind of thing, a way to sort of bemuse and hypnotize and befuddle Hitler to think that he should take information and trust certain people and get rid of other people who are in his immediate circle of advisors. A fascinating study by Dennis Wheatley. You know, he wrote this, one of the books was called They Used Dark Forces, and that's what he means exactly, that they were manipulating the superstitious nature of people like Heinrich Himmler and Adolf Hitler in order to make it for the West's and the Allies' advantage militarily.
There's a recent book about the drugs or the medicines that a doctor was administering to Hitler. I think it's just been out a few weeks now. I forget the name of it. But it's fascinating. I listened to an interview. I think it was on NPR. And it was fascinating, the drugs that were being administered to Adolf Hitler especially toward the end of the war, you know.
That's right. I mean, yeah, he was in a terrible state, and this is how Bormann was able to manipulate him, control him.
Right.
He really
right.
trusted Bormann, and Bormann would be present at all of the interviews. And if Bormann liked what the person was saying, he would tell Hitler what a great guy they were. And if Bormann didn't like, he wasn't getting the advice that Bormann wanted him to, then Bormann would poison Hitler's mind against that person. The other thing, really important thing to understand is that around about August 1944, Hitler issued this thing called the Nero Decree, which was that every single inch of land that the Allies were going to take off of the retreating German forces was going to be burnt, a scorched earth policy. All factories, all bridges, all destroyed. Yet Bormann completely overturned that. Hitler never found out, apparently, that Bormann had overturned that, because Bormann was already working with these big American and British corporations who wanted the Germans, industrialists, to survive after the war. So they were making sure the factories were left intact, the bridges were left intact. There's even questions about the crossing of the Rhine at Remagen that General Patton did, whether Bormann deliberately allowed the Americans across the bridge there and arranged for it to happen so that the Americans could get an advantage, and also that the bridge wouldn't be blown up, because this was Bormann's policy. He wanted the Allies to have a relatively easy ride after sort of September 1944 or Christmas 1944, in and make the Russians do most of the fighting. That was Bormann's plan, because he wanted to join with the Allies, Bormann did, and certainly the other Nazis, like Goebbels, for example, wanted to join with the Allies of the remains of the German armies and actually fight the Russians. In fact, Churchill, through Operation Unthinkable, actually wanted to use the nuclear bombs to bomb Moscow immediately after the end of the war. And he had to be kept off the radio, Churchill did, in late 1945 and 1946, had to be kept off the radio and television in Britain because he was coming out with all these harebrained maniac schemes to nuke Moscow.
My God, there's a lot of intrigue, isn't there, Tony? You get a bunch of conspiracy people around, and you know what I mean? But also, there are conspiracies, and that's one of the main things. People that are talking about what we're talking about can easily be categorized and portrayed as conspiracy nuts. Are you getting some of that in UK at times?
Oh, yes. I sort of almost in a way invite it, because you can always come back with the answer that, well, this is the CIA phrase they used, they invented, in order to smear Mark Lane, who was
It came out of the JFK assassination period.
Mark Lane was right on the ball, George. He really was.
He
very
was.
Close. And many people came to him because they knew he was very close to Kennedy and told him about the involvement of the CIA, of David Attlee Phillips, of Lyndon Johnson, Alan Dulles, these various other people, involvement behind the scenes in the assassination, really signing it off, because they knew that they had to make sure that there was going to be a good cover-up afterwards before they allowed the assassination to take place. And as Mark Lane was getting close to these stories, the CIA started to panic, and they came up with this term conspiracy theory. So in a way, I'm quite happy to be labelled with the same ridiculous label that Mark Lane was, as he was such a brilliant guy, brilliant writer, and a definite, honest, truthful man who was a true fighter for freedom and a true American patriot.
Well, Judith Ferry Baker is continuing to have the JFK conferences in Dallas, and I've been part of the last three in some one way or another. I produced video on the first two up there. But anyway,
it's a little bit closer for you to get there, George.
Oh, yeah. It's just about 225 miles north. 225 from Austin north, 225 miles.
Yeah, so I'd love to come over there. That sounds a really good thing to come over. So is that happening every year? When are they?
Usually in November, I've forgotten the date on this one. This may be just a few days before the 22nd of November, the way the weekend works out,
I was talking about the JFK assassination on National New Zealand Radio this week.
Oh, okay.
On one of the phone-ins, the Mark Sainsbury phone-in on Radio Live, which is a national station here in New Zealand. And when they had this book released by Nikki Hager this week, I thought I'd better phone in and talk about it. And the presenter himself started steering the conversation away from just talking about this. And he's saying, well, what about conspiracies? And he was absolutely behind the JFK, was killed by the CIA, Lyndon Johnson conspiracy. In fact, he started it was almost like I pressed the button with him. And certainly it seems that, some of the mainstream press in New Zealand is absolutely happy to discuss that. That's exactly what happened, is that it was definitely an inside job, and that Lee Harvey Oswald was the patsy. And there were very powerful forces within America that killed their own president, and that was normal. But he started to get a little bit nervous when we got onto the subject of Princess Diana and her being executed or assassinated, and he sort of shut the conversation down a bit at that point. But it's quite, there seems to be a slightly more realistic attitude in New Zealand towards the idea that the government might be so corrupt it would cover up and kill in order to get its way, and that there is this sort of level of lack of accountability at the very, very highest levels that enables people to do these kind of murderous deeds with impunity, with the idea that somebody somewhere is going to cover up for them and protect them and cover their backs, like with this, the example of this punishment killing in Afghanistan with the involvement of the Apache helicopters, the Americans and the New Zealand SAS. This is something that is great to see, George, when patriotic soldiers will come to an investigative journalist, come to the public and say, we've seen this happen, we want the public to know, we want the public to be informed, because we're not going to be part of the cover-up.
Exactly, exactly. This last JFK, I did 11 interviews up there in a special room off to the side, and I interviewed Roger Stone, all those people up there, but I've interviewed Sean Stone also, you know, over the years and so forth, and that he was there also speaking. Barr McClellan was part of the Ed Clark law firm, which represented LBJ here in Austin during that period. He has quite a story to tell. And his former wife, his first wife, was the mayor of Austin at one time.
And, well, you could almost post-World War II, the JFK is the mother of all conspiracies.
Yes, yes.
Because it set the stage, didn't it? After the
it was a consolidation.
The positive vibe after World War II, suddenly there's this dark force at work. Yeah,
exactly.
And also, of course, with the with the tremendous amount of Nazi scientists and Nazi individuals that were in the Americas, not just North America, South America too, having their influence, and things like the Korean War, the Vietnam War. Now look at Korea now. This has had a massive impact on the present day, where you've got massively escalating, rising tensions between North and South Korea. It almost looks to me as if this is going to be a flashpoint and some kind of cull going on here between these poor people who've been artificially separated by this ridiculous war after World War II.
Yeah, my feeling on this is that the Chinese, I think, are getting a little tired of the North Koreans and their troublemaking, you know, because they're creating a regional nuclear danger in the area. You see what I mean? And I think the Chinese have more to lose. They always say they're the lapdog. They were in the past, but I think the Chinese are changing their view of North Korea. That's what my feeling is.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the long term, I think we're really looking at a U.S.-China conflict.
That's right.
Two big sides.
Yeah,
superpowers.
Exactly. So,
but you see, that conflict will be initiated by one of these smaller areas sparking it off, I think. You know, something like maybe the South China Sea, the Spratly Islands, or Korea, or somewhere like that, you know, where there is a kind of peripheral dispute. And, I mean, let's face it, the United States has been interfering in the countries around the periphery of China ever since the end of the war. I mean, obviously, Vietnam is another one, not just Korea. Places like Malaysia, the Singapore, I noticed, by the way, the Singapore government, I mean, they are not democratic in Singapore, but they seem to run things very well, is that they are absolutely guaranteeing that they're going to be an independent country. They say, well, we're not going to be allied with any of the main powers in the world. We are going to be an independent city-state. And they've been very adamant about that every single one, even the poorest, the most disabled of all their citizens, will be protected, and they'll be part of their defense policy and their defense plan, and that they have no wish to take part in the war on terror in any way. So there are some countries around that periphery who've actually, in a way, been radicalized by the attempts of the British and the US to interfere with them and use them as a kind of cat's paw against China.
Right. I want to thank you tonight, Tony, for being with us. All the way from New Zealand right now, but you sounded
right,
really
I'm
good.
Handle.
But thank you very much for being with us, and I appreciate you coming on during your vacation and so forth. And you're doing some work down there. I heard for the first time testimony, and that's great, Tony.
Well, that's right. I think it's quite good to get on the radio.
Yes.
Some New Zealanders. You know what, George? I would always urge people to go on radio phone-ins. And you know what happened after I was on? I only did about 5 minutes, 10 minutes or something.
What's that?
And afterwards, you got loads of New Zealanders phoning up on the whole sort of conspiracy.
Say that again. You dropped out on me. You dropped.
After. It takes somebody to get on there and open up the discussion a little bit to give others the confidence to.
So say that again. You dropped out a little bit on the connection.
Okay, yeah. Just to say, I always encourage people to go on radio phone-ins. Because what happened here in New Zealand on Radio Live is I was on there for 5 or 10 minutes, and it just opened the discussion up. You know, after I'd been on, a whole load of other people were calling in.
Well, that's great. Tony, you're doing a good job. Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate all the hard work you've done, Tony.
Thank you, and God bless you.
Okay, bless you. Good night.